Content, but it's late at night content, so good evening, everybody, and welcome. It's 11 p.m. Eastern Time, Wednesday, April 14th, 2021, and thank you for joining us for the 107th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you for that. I'm all kinds of excited because I recognize what that was again. Yeah, go me. All right, and if you would please, for the audience who is not me, please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic, if you would, please.
So as I suspect everybody who heard the opening bars of that know, that is Life in the Fast Lane, which is the third song off the first side of the Hotel California record done by the Eagles, co-authored by Don Henley and Joe Walsh. And I can't remember if Glenn Frey was a co-author of that or not. It's predominantly a Joe Walsh song. And the story, for those who don't know, the story goes that Joe Walsh was playing the opening riff as a finger exercise, the little opening part. And Glenn Frey was walking by and he goes, during the sessions of Hotel California, And Glenn Frey goes, "What's that?" And Joe Walsh goes, "Oh, it's just a finger exercise, kind of like, you know, rubbing your stomach and scratching your nose at the same time, kind of thing." He goes, "Nope." He goes, "That's a song." That's how life in the fast lane was born. So, you know, weird shit happens. And sometimes mistakes in the studio turn out to be woohoos. So the reason that I decided to pick that one is because, once again, we are going to be discussing folks who live life in the fast lane and things that they do that they probably shouldn't be doing, not the least of which is relapsing on their addiction of choice.
Yes, definitely. All righty. So as Dr. Mathis mentions, tonight's episode is entitled Addiction Recidivism, which we will discuss in a moment. So before we begin talking about our topic tonight, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Okay, so I thought since I'm doing life in the fast lane, and since one of the instruments used to do that, excuse me, was a Telecaster-type guitar, and that's also what I used for tonight, except I was using a Telecaster-type guitar made by the guitar company Iconic, which make really good guitars, so I thought I'd give them a shout-out. I'm doing a bio tonight on a very famous rockabilly guy, Carl Lee Perkins, who most people know as Carl Perkins, who is best known for writing all kinds of music and did a lot of work at the Sun Studios in Memphis back in the day, and has been a pretty prolific songwriter over the years and has done work with a bunch of folks and has written such things as Matchbox and Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby and his probably most famous song, Blue Suede Shoes. So a lot of people know Blue Suede Shoes, but they don't know that he was the author. And his work has been copied, and his stuff has been covered by everybody from Johnny Cash to Eric Clapton to Elvis Presley to Jimi Hendrix and to the Beatles. The Beatles did a lot of his tunes in their early stuff. And in fact, in their original early stuff, the person that was supposed to sing Matchbox, that started out singing Matchbox, was actually John Lennon, and eventually it got given to Ringo. And so he ended, I'm sorry, not Matchbox, Honey Don't, which was also one of his songs. And it was given to Ringo to sing because originally John Lennon was the vocalist on that. And they said, oh, let's let Ringo try that one. That's kind of more his speed. So that's kind of what happened with that. But Perkins was originally from Tiptonville, which is a small town in Tennessee. And actually, you know, you hear jokes about this, but his parents were really sharecroppers. That's no lie. But and so when he wasn't at school, he was working in the fields with his parents. Grew up hearing a bunch of country stuff and Southern gospel music, mostly done by African-American field workers. And so eventually he got into the Grand Ole Opry stuff, listening to it through the radio, because back in the day that was big deal. And a lot of the radio broadcasts were done by a very famous Grand Ole Opry person, Roy Acuff, who was also a very famous musician. And eventually he got so inspired that his dad actually made him kind of a broomstick and cigar box type guitar, just, you know, for a 6-year-old kid, so he could like mess around with it. When he was, you know, the makeshift kind of thing. And eventually one of his neighbors, sold an old beat up worn out guitar that was a kind of a Gene Autry type guitar. And evidently had nylon strings on it. And when he would break the strings, it was so poor he couldn't afford to buy new strings, so he'd just have to kind of like retie them. So it was kind of interesting. But he taught himself how to play a lot of songs, including Roy Acuff's Great Speckled Bird, which is a big famous song by him, and so was the Wabash Cannonball, which a lot of people know. All right. And so he cites a lot of his influences being everybody from that to Bill Monroe, to the African-American field workers he dealt with, and a lot of the other country folks. So eventually he moves from Tennessee, in the small town of Tennessee, and they actually move to Madison County, which is a place, they were in a place called Lake County, which is where Tiftonville is, and moved closer to Memphis, which is in Madison County. So by the time he was at age 14, he'd been exposed to all kinds of forms of music at that point, and wrote a country song at age 14 called Let Me Take You to the Movie Mag, and eventually got Sun Records to Sam Phillips, who owned Sun Records, and he eventually signed him to a recording deal. So, you know, that's what started his journey, and he was 14 years old at the time. And so one of the songs that they would play on there was A Blue Moon of Kentucky, which is a very famous Bill Monroe song. And they were playing it, you know, all over the radio and the bars and the taverns, and Perkins would get in and play. Because, you know, back in the day, people didn't give a flip about what you were, you know, and they would get in. And so he got in and started, you know, jamming around with these guys. And they said, well, oh, this kid can play pretty well. And so he started, that kind of started his career. So he started playing, you know, with all these guys and jamming with a bunch of people, and eventually kind of got, you know, got well known, and eventually got in with his some of his brothers to appear on this show, the Early Morning Farm and Home Show. Didn't that sound bucolic? And they were very, very well known, in especially in the Jackson area. And they just started playing around a lot, and he kind of literally started from the ground up. He had known this woman, I think her name was Valda or Valda Kreider, whom he eventually married in 53, and then she started working at the bakery and reduced to part-time because he was playing, by this time he was playing six nights a week and playing with all these different folks with his brothers, and then playing with all these other pickup jobs he was doing. And eventually had made some tapes that made their way to Columbia and RCA Records, and eventually got signed to them. So when 54, he had heard Elvis do a new version of Blue Moon of Kentucky, and that was back in the day when he was still using Scotty Moore on guitar and Bill Black. And, you know, he just was very, very, very impressed with that. And, you know, eventually got released. The record that he made with Sam Phillips, Movie Mag, got released, and that just started blowing up. And people like Elvis Presley heard his music, and they were like, oh my God, this is really great. And so he goes on to release another Sun Records in 1995, and just kind of kept on going. And then he actually wrote and released Blue Suede Shoes in 56, and that is what really blew his career up. And after that, it was just all kind of crazy stuff went on with him. And, you know, he had all these engagements out of everywhere. I mean, he was traveling and touring and doing all kinds of stuff, and eventually got into a big row over royalties with Sam Phillips. And I don't know the details behind that. I don't know if there was some kind of funky agreement between he and Sam or what the heck happened, but eventually Perkins got ownership of the songs, but that wasn't until on into the 70s. And in the meantime, Beatles, you know, who were big rockabilly freaks, had heard a bunch of his songs and will record and started recording his stuff. So a lot of the stuff off their early records, you know, were basically Carl Perkins songs. And Paul McCartney once said that if they weren't Carl Perkins, it would not have been a Beatles. He also said the same thing about Buddy Holly and the Crickets. So this is the era that they were very, very, very much influenced by. And, of course, folks such as Lee Rocker, who was one of the Stray Cats, that Slim Jim Phantom, both of whom were the Stray Cats, recorded Blue Suede Shoes in 85 with them. And that will actually ended up on the movie Porky's Revenge. So he's gotten a lot of airplay in a lot of unusual places. One of the things that really kind of caught my attention and kind of got me into the world of Carl Perkins, so to speak, otherwise, other than, of course, the Beatles, who I, you know, who were very familiar with, was in 1985, there was a television special called Blue Suede Shoes, a Rockabilly Session, which actually was recorded, it was taped live and later released. I think it was in the Limehouse Studios in London, but don't quote me on that one. And there was all kinds of uber famous people who were on there, including Eric Clapton, George Harrison, Dave Edmunds of Rockpile, Roseanne Cash, Ringo Starr, and Lee Rocker. And they were all in there doing songs with him. And I mean, it was just really kind of cool. I have a copy of that. It was really, it's some pretty hot stuff. But I mean, he has done all kinds of stuff, including doing a one-time acting stint on one of John Landis's films. I think it was called Into the Night, which also features David Bowie, which I thought was kind of interesting. Anyway, in 86 he goes, which is the year, a couple of years after that, he goes back to Sun Records, Sun Studio in Memphis, and does sessions with Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, Roy Orbison. And they did an album called The Class of 55, because that was the era they all came up on. So this is a guy who has definitely gotten around. I mean, he's co-written and played on The Judge's record. I think the one he played on was Let Me Tell You About Love. But he's performed with Joan Jett. He's performed with Charlie Daniels, Chet Atkins, Paul Schaefer, and has had all these folks guest play on his records. He's performed with the Kentucky Headhunters. I mean, he's done a lot of stuff. He played with Duane Eddy, who is another huge person during that era. He's done duets with Bono and John Fogerty of Creedence and Willie Nelson and Paul Simon and Tom Petty. And so I mean, he has definitely gotten around and was kind of had taken a small sabbatical and was coming back from music and unfortunately developed throat cancer. And his last performance was at the Royal Albert Hall during a show, Music for Montserrat, which was a charity event. And I think that was maybe 4 or 5 months before he passed in 97. And I think his last record was released in 96. In addition to a lot of his music stuff, he was a huge child abuse advocate and had done a lot of charity events and donated a boatload of money to establish prevention of child abuse, safe houses and that sort of thing. Did an annual telethon for the Circle of Hope, which generated all kinds of money to keep their stuff open to, as a haven for abused kids. I mean, he was really, 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 really active in that. And, you know, as I said, eventually it passed, I think, in 98, I think in mid or late January of 98 of the throat cancer. But he'd also had some TIAs. Trans ischemic attacks prior to that. there's been all kind of monuments and plaques in his honor. He's also been inducted into the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and the Rockabilly Hall of Fame, and the Memphis Music Hall of Fame. So he is definitely a rockabilly force to be contended with. And most of the people you talk to who know of his music, even a lot of the big movers and shakers will say that he was a huge influence in the field and was really kind of the architect of the rockabilly movement and a big reason for that to be so popular as it was and was often called the quote-unquote king of rockabilly. And as I said, influenced everybody from Hendrix to the Beatles to, you know, just everybody on the planet. So I think a lot of rock people would not be aware of this guy's presence. I mean, George Thorogood, for God's sake, covered one of his songs on their album Maverick, and I think they covered Dixie Fried. But, you know, as I said, you can't be a music devotee and not know this guy. So even though he's predominantly rockabilly, his songs and picking styles and influence really affected a lot of people. particularly the cross-picking things that he would do, which was a big influence on Harrison's guitar work, both with the Beatles and post-Beatles. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
All righty. Well, thank you very much for that. Okay. Again, we will be taking calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight. So feel free to give us a call, and the number is 914-338-0314. Okay. So, speaking of deviating from the normal genre, tonight we are deviating just a bit from our usual show format in a couple of ways. First, while we acknowledge that musically the focus of our show has been and continues to be essentially classic rock, traditional metal, and related genres, tonight's topic came out of conversations around news circled around a well-known rap artist named DMX, who recently overdosed and died of medical damage that was inflicted by this overdose. That was in the last few days. His situation has raised a bigger question with many people about how things got to this point, and perhaps either how to break the pattern or, unfortunately, how best to cope with things if you or the addict cannot do so, as in his case. Secondly, we may discuss this topic tonight in a much more extempore fashion than usual, rather than the formatting that we typically use. And hopefully this will give our listeners a chance to consider a lot of different points that come up in similar situations. So without numbering or categories, basically we're going to discuss some details in the beginning about DMX's story. Because this is very similar to many other such stories about struggling addicts, both in the entertainment world and in everyday life. And we will dive into the complexities of why addicts with a seemingly solid support system still can ultimately fail or otherwise self-destruct. And we will try to talk a little bit about how to cope with it when someone to whom you are close has this kind of crisis, or if you're the person who's in crisis and despite your best intentions and support system, it's just not working out. So we'll talk about these things and related topics kind of freeform tonight. Before we get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you'd like to bring up before we dive in.
Yeah, I just want to say that addictions are certainly not relegated to the rock genre or the hard rock, heavy metal genre or the pop rock genre or the blues genre or the jazz genre or the country genre or the country rock genre or the rap hip-hop genre or the soul disco genre or the funk genre or anything else. They're not even limited to music, because there's a lot of athletes and actors and actresses and people you never heard of, the everyday Joes and Jolene's, physicians, dentists, psychologists, psychiatrists, bricklayers, plumbers, chefs, everybody. It is a huge problem. And, so it knows no race, it knows no creed, it knows no nationality or socioeconomic status or financial security or lack thereof, or degrees or lack thereof. I mean, it's an equal opportunity bigot in its many forms. And I want to say that because a lot of people, when they think of addictions, they think, drugs and alcohol. And certainly that is an addiction. But so is compulsive working. So is hoarding, right? So is compulsive religiosity, right? Anything that one does to excess that interferes with their life is by definition an addiction. And so I don't want, gambling, I don't want people to think of addictions as just drugs and alcohol, because they expand the relationship genre and, just all kinds of different areas. And so it impacts a shoot ton of people. It's just the folks that you typically hear about are the famous politicians or musicians or athletes or people who are in the public eye. You don't hear about the clergyman and the therapists and Joe and Jolene Average. You don't hear about those folks very often. But it's everywhere. And so I think it behooves us to address this irrespective of whether they're a rock person or even a musician or not, because, you know, it's everywhere. And we're all subject to it if we don't, you know, mind our P's and Q's, so to speak.
Absolutely. And, yes, that is very important to remember. And the main reason I'm bringing up this one particular person is just because what happened to him raises the question about the support system. But this could be anyone. It could be somebody who's famous, somebody who's not. So I absolutely understand, and I hope our listeners are on board with that. So this is really just an example that raises an important question. All right, let's go ahead and dive in. So the first part I want to talk about is DMX's story and how this is similar to many such stories about struggling addicts in entertainment and in everyday life, you know, all walks of life. So DMX had a long history of struggling with substance abuse all the way back into his early teens. He was first given marijuana laced with crack cocaine by a music mentor when he was just barely beginning his music career. And I believe, if memory serves, he was around 14 years old when this happened. And he didn't handle it very well, obviously, and this started a cascade of problems as he was getting more and more famous, more and more attention, people trying to get a piece of him, and things just kept going from there. He's been in and out of rehab multiple times. He has previously overdosed, including a fairly publicized 2016 incident where he was revived with Narcan. It got so bad. Where his story becomes relevant to the work we do on this show is that he had access to a loving family and a significant amount of mental health and medical help. Yet, in spite of a great deal of support and a life that to most of us appears to be worth fighting for, and he's even sung about that, how much, you know, he loved his family and appreciated all that, he kept going back to the drugs. This is a pattern we have seen throughout professional music culture in most genres, if not all, as Dr. Mathis said, and also, as he said, not just music. Additionally, DMX's music was a little bit different than a lot of typical rappers coming out in the 90s and early 2000s. You know, remember, a lot of this was the heyday of gangster rap. And there's elements of that in there, but several of his albums displayed a poetic and proactive self-awareness of his problem and a seemingly sincere desire to go get out and to do better. An interesting pattern that DMX used on his first several albums was one of his ways of attempting to process his addiction and try to break away. He would include two specific kinds of songs on each album, and he did this several times. There was a pattern, and then the pattern broke a little bit, but what he would do is he'd have one song on the album that's dedicated to telling a story about getting suckered in by the devil. He refers to him as Damien, and there are these songs about being befriended, and then Damien screws him over and ruins his life. And then another song later in the album would be a prayer and a song to God about helping him getting back on the right path. And it was always, I've really screwed up, I need you in my life kind of songs. For example, the first one in 98, It's Dark and Hell is Hot, there was a song for the devil, Damien, and then a prayer and a song to God was prayer, a skit, and then the convo. Flesh of my flesh, blood of my blood, same year later, the devil's song was The Omen. Seeing a theme here. And then the song to God was Ready to Meet Him, and meet him being to meet God and to try to get right with him. And then the next one was, and then there was X, and there wasn't a song to Damien, but there was a prayer number three, and then a song called Angel with Gina Bell. And then the Great Depression in 2001, there was Damien 3, the prayer for A Minute for Your Son, and that means, you know, he was a son, a child of God. And then there was a song later, and I didn't catch what album it's on. I just saw the single. It's called Lord, Give Me a Sign. So there was this constant theme about talking about street life and how it was sucking him in and screwing him over and then trying to get right and get out. And he knows that it was a problem. He knows he's getting sucked in. He's always singing about it. And I've gone into a lot of specific detail here about DMX's situation so that our listeners understand that we're specifically looking at situations over a long period of time where the addicted person, at least outwardly, seems to be trying to do a lot of things to break the pattern, and yet it keeps repeating in spite of this. And this was the question that what happened to DMX brought up that is relevant to all addicts in this situation who are in it long time and are not stopping. So this situation raises these issues. First, there are some addicts who can use their support and resources to stop, and they do. And many are not ready to try, or they do try at first, but they give up for a variety of reasons. You know, it's hard, requires a lot of discipline, shame topics, all kinds of stuff. Here's a question here we can get into briefly. We're going to get into it quite a bit in a while, but real briefly, what would you say, Dr. Mathis, are the common aspects that those who do succeed in quitting have, in short?
Well, that's a really good question. What I often see, because I work a lot with this population, I mean, 85% of my caseload are substance abuse, are moderate to severe substance abusers / addicts. And those who tend to be more successful tend to have a lot of the things that BMX had. They have a good family or social support system. They have the resources to engage in ongoing counseling, right? So they do those sorts of things. But from an internal intrapsychic perspective, folks who tend to be more successful tend to have higher levels of self-esteem. They have higher levels of self-efficacy. They have higher levels of self-confidence, and they tend to be a little more internally oriented. They have a somewhat higher internal locus of control, or at least amenable to developing that aspect of them. They also, the ones who are more successful, tend to be more sticking. They either have a slightly higher level of abstract reasoning ability, or they're willing to take direction and be very concrete and just do exactly what they're told to do and not anything else. Most of the time, addicts, any form of addiction compulsive behavior is really just an escape avoidance tool. So if they don't dig deep and deal with the stuff inside themselves that causes them to use drugs and alcohol or whatever their addiction is to begin with, they're not going to be successful. And that's the one thing that all successfully stopping addicts do. They fix the internal thing that is causing them to try to use an external solution to an internal problem, which is drugs and alcohol or sex or whatever the thing is. But if you don't fix the internal problem, you just keep going from one thing to the next thing to the next thing to the next thing. So eventually the internal thing comes back and you don't know what to do with it. You don't have the coping skills or whatever, and your coping skill is to get drunk or to get stoned or whatever, and that's what they do.
Gotcha. And we'll probably come back to this in a bit and poke it in a little more depth. So the other question it brings up is it's clearly not enough simply to have some family or friends are willing to support the addict, whatever that even means, because sometimes people like to say, oh, I support you, I'm here for you. But when it comes time to act on it, they realize they overpromised. Is there anything brief that you can say to that aspect of it, you know, the people that have stuff in place? It's not enough. And I think you've already touched on it some, that it seems to be about being able to make those changes and having the wherewithal to stick to a program, make decisions, and do it. You know, is that really what this is about? Like why some people who have support don't make it?
Yeah, it's about internal resources, first and foremost. The external stuff is great, and I'm certainly not minimizing it. And a lot of times that's, you know, that can make a difference in somebody who's a little shaky on the internal stuff. But ultimately it comes down to what have you got inside of you and what internal resources do you have and or what internal resources can you develop or reinforce and claim, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you folks hear me say a lot, take your power back. And a lot of folks who have relapse issues and who struggle with addiction lifelong don't ever do that. They don't ever take their power back because they don't really believe they have it, or they you know, don't believe they can do it, or they believe it exists, but they don't think, oh, you know, my mom, who had a very high IQ and was very talented at a bunch of things, was not an addict, but easily could have been. And she said that's the reason I don't do, even though she had anxiety and depression all of her life, that was the reason she wouldn't do anti-anxiety medication, is because it has a high addiction potential. And anytime she would take it, when they would, she'd have to go in the hospital for a procedure or whatever, and they would give her, you know, Xanax or whatever to calm down, she's like, oh, I can't be doing this. I like it too much. So she had an awareness that this is probably something she didn't want to start doing. But she was pretty miserable most of her life with that. And, you know, it's just sad. And I would say, okay, Mom, well, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this, and you can do this. And she would pull the yes, but game. That's a transactional analysis term. So it's like, yeah, you know, I'm sure that stuff works for other people, but it doesn't work for me because, and then she would give all the excuses why it doesn't work. Because I'm too dumb. I'm like, yeah, right, Mom. I'm not competent. Oh, gee, I just don't know. I don't have the resources. Oh, it's every excuse under the goddamn sun. And the problem with that is she really believed it. And a lot of addicts who don't stop, who have self-esteem, self-efficacy issues like my mom did, they believe it too. They really believe that they can't do it. And if they can't grasp their head around that, they're going to fail. And that's true of anybody trying anything. If you really don't believe that you can do it, you're probably going to be right because you're going to fulfill your prophecy, right? And you've got to just put that stuff aside and go, I'm going to do this in spite of the fact that I don't really think I can. I'm just going to act like I can. I'm going to act like I believe I can. I'm going to take what this guy says as truth because he's got all this crap on the wall, so he obviously knows what we're talking about. Maybe I just need to shut my stuff down and try what he's telling me. You know, and those folks who do that find themselves to be pretty successful, and then that reinforces their sense of, hey, wait a minute, maybe I can do this, and then they're off and running. But they got to stick with it, and the first 2 years are the worst. I mean, 90-something percent of the people, if they're going to relapse on a drug, they're going to do it in the first, actually 60-something percent are going to do it in the first 6 months. And if you're making it 2 years clean, you can usually, you're probably going to stay the course. You know, you're like 90-plus percent in the safe zone. That doesn't mean you're totally safe. But if you can make it 2 years without any relapsing at all, you're probably in a, you're not, just statistically speaking, you're in a much, much, much better place. And the likelihood of you remaining abstinent lifelong is really good. But a lot of folks don't make that far.
Fair enough. Okay. We're going to come back and examine these points and some other related points in a few minutes. Real quick, I want to go over, for the benefit of our listeners, a recap of previous shows that we've done that pertain to various aspects of the problem of addiction, in case there are further thoughts you guys might want to explore by going back to them. This is probably our number one topic on this show, is various forms of addiction and some of the consequences, like suicidal ideations and that stuff. So our very first show ever, Musicians and Suicide. This was back in July of 2016. And while this first show, as I just mentioned, focuses on suicide, but addiction, as we found out when we dug into why all these musicians were suicidal, the number one reason is that they had addiction issues. And this is often an underlying aspect of fostering suicidal ideations in many people. The next time we talked about it was episode 4, which was a 12-step addiction program alternative show, and that was in September 2016. Those of you who follow us regularly know that Dr. Mathis and I are not real big on the 12-step model, And this show explains a lot about why. And, you know, we're not poo-pooing that some people have improved and the programs help them out, but it's not because of scientific credibility. Basically, it's fellowship, and anybody can make fellowship. That's not really medical training. And so we talk about some alternatives for that. And those of you who are struggling may want to go back to that show, because we do give other resources that you could use instead. So I recommend that one if addiction is an issue and you're out of resources locally. Episode 10, maintaining sobriety and health during the holidays. That was a three-part episode about coping during the holidays. And one of the coping topics we talked about is those who have addiction problems, and then you have to go back home to your family, as we often do during the holidays. And for many people who have addictions and other similar problems, family is often a trigger, you know, either something they're doing or not doing. And like Dr. Mathis mentioned, a lot of people who survive this and do well have self-esteem. And one of the places where self-esteem takes a beating, if it ever got to grow in the first place, is at the family. So this is a big thing. This was in December 2016. You can listen to all three parts if you want, but the part to do with addiction is in the middle. That's episode 10. And then episode 17, which was the heroin comeback, and that was based on some news articles about a resurgence in heroin use. And that was March of 2017. And then episode 20 was kind of a follow-up to episode 17. It was medical marijuana and the opioid epidemic. That was in May of 2017. Then episode 38, which was gaming addiction. You know, as Dr. Mathis mentioned, not all addictions have anything to do with a substance per se. You know, it can be a habit or an action or an inaction that we don't do. So this one was all about gaming. That was January of 2018. Episode 49, is there anybody out there? July of 2018. And this was about the failings of our societal suicide support system. And again, even though this show also focuses on suicide, it touches on support system failure. And so that might be of value to some people interested in tonight's topic. You know, if you don't have a support system, that's a very good reason why a lot of people have recidivism. And then two more, episode 66 and 67, which are a two-part episode that addiction is not a disease. And we talk about this at great length for those of you who might be tempted to correct us. We have receipts on these shows. April of 2019, beginning of April and the middle of April, because they're 2 weeks apart. So those are the episodes that we've done that touch on related aspects of addiction and its various forms and or support systems and consequences of addiction. I'm going to check in with you real quick, Dr. Mathis, and see if there was anything that you wanted to bring up about this, but it's just a list of episodes, so I don't know, but I'll give you an opportunity if you want it.
No, I'm good. Thank you.
All right. So the next part I want to talk about, I don't have a lot to say. This is really free form, but we want to talk about why people relapse even with support. As I've mentioned already, this was the giant question that DMX's situation brought up for people. A lot of places talk about 12 steps and support systems and groups and things to talk to about, you know, with your family. And we have all these conversations and it keeps happening. So as we mentioned earlier, this is the main focus of the evening. If one gets to the point where one has people and professionals lined up to support them and yet they keep falling back down and relapsing, what is most likely behind this, and what can people do to better their chances of not relapsing? And this is where we'll probably get back into the things you talked about earlier, maybe in a little more detail, but I'm going to leave that up to you if you would be willing to talk about this part.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to talk about some generic things, and then if you feel like there are certain things you want me to expound on, just, you know, ask me. Basically, there's a lot of things people can do to increase their chances of not relapsing. Social support appropriate social support being one of them. Part of the social support also has to do with friends, family, whatever, not engaging in addictive behaviors when they're around this person. So if they say they support this person and the person's trying to quit smoking cigarettes, let's say, and they have people in their, you know, support system that are cigarette smokers, you probably want to leave that shit at home. You don't want to bring cigarettes to somebody and smoke cigarettes around somebody who's trying to quit cigarettes or have the cigarettes pack visible or vaping or anything else in this person's presence. That's not helping. Or having a drink with somebody who's trying to stop drinking or taking a toot for somebody who's trying to quit, you know, cocaine or whatever. So choosing a social milieu and social support system that are going to put their behaviors where their mouths are, so to speak, and, you know, role model the very behavior that they want you to do and that is helpful for you to do. So that's certainly one thing you can do. If you have an existential spiritual bent, following up with that, if you have a let me rephrase that. If you have a healthy spiritual existential path that you follow, then by all means, you know, certainly you can rely on that. That's also been shown to be an assist for people who are attempting to not relapse. But healthy spirituality doesn't mean demonizing the drug and anthropomorphizing the drug, which I'm hearing BMX did, but that's not uncommon because that's a typical thing that AA and the 12-step people do. So if you look, for example, at Ozzy Osbourne's recording, No Rest for the Wicked, there's a song in there called Demon Alcohol. And he literally anthropomorphizes alcohol like it's some demonic, satanic creature that's going after him with a brain and an intention. And so it's all this external crap that gets reinforced. And if you look at a lot of the stuff that's in the big book and the 12-step literature, it's about, you know, demonizing and somehow drugs and alcohol become human or they have some sort of consciousness and intention to destroy us. And that kind of thinking is not going to lead you to successful non-relapse. You have to own it. You have to take responsibility for it. You have to recognize that you have made a choice to use drugs. You've made a choice to let your life be out of control, if you will. And you have to make the choice and take the responsibility to take it back. If you don't take responsibility for it, you are not going to change it. So you can't be demonizing the alcohol and the drugs. You go, oh, my God, if it weren't for that. And that was what Bill and Bob tried to do with the guys who started 12 Steps. One was a preacher and one was an alcoholic, and neither one of them could quit drinking. Excuse me, one was a preacher alcoholic and one was a physician alcoholic, and they could not stop drinking. That's why they piled up with the Women's Temperance Movement, so that they could get drugs and alcohol outlawed, which of course they did, and then because they were looking for an external source to keep them sober, and they couldn't do it because it got repealed, and then they went, well, let's use another resource. Let's let God take it over. You know? And I'm like, okay, it's one thing to ask God for help. It's another thing to say, hey, you know, I need you to restore me, quote unquote, to restore me to sanity. Oh my gosh, please give me a break. No external loss of control, people. We already know that that is a bad psychological construct, particularly in America, and that it leads to people relying on somebody else or something else to do their work for them, and that never works well, ever. One thing to ask an external source for assistance, it's the next thing to say, okay, let's go. And get busy about it because I got a six-pack in the refrigerator and I'm thinking about drinking it. Come on, right? The other thing you can do that you see that will increase your chance of not relapsing is not having that stuff in and around you. Don't have it in your house. Don't have it in your immediate environment. If you're a musician, for example, which I am, as everyone knows, and I'm around that stuff all the time, but I'm also a guy who's never been drunk, who's never done drugs ever, because I'm a control freak and no druggie I've ever seen is in control of their own life, and that's too frightening for me. I'm too much of a chicken shit for that. Let's just be honest. And, you know, if drugs and alcohol run in your family, don't even think you can go there, especially if they run on both sides of your family, because we know that has a genetic component. Does that mean you're going to be an alcoholic? No, because it runs on both sides of my family, because if you don't choose to use, you can't engage and make the gene express itself because you're not choosing to use. Hello, McFly. All right, so don't even start down that road. But if you have started down that road and made a mistake, and we all make mistakes, none of us are perfect, I make plenty of them, you know, you just have to be smart about how you don't repeat the mistakes. So part of this is, instead of beating the crap out of yourself for being a drug addict or an alcoholic, look at the thinking steps you took and look at the feeling, the emotional steps you took that led you to think it would be okay to relapse, or that put you in an emotional state or put you in an environmental situation where you're tempted to use drugs. Right? Don't go to parties if you're a druggie, especially the first 2 years. Do not put yourself in a tempting environment. You're probably not going to be able to withstand it. You know, you can't go to a party where there's going to be drugs and alcohol and you say, okay, well, I can just pass. I'll stay on that end of the room where the punch bowl is that doesn't have alcohol in it, and I'm just going to eat Cheetos and Doritos and sip fruit punch and hang out and, you know, cruise the girls or cruise the guys or the goats or whatever your thing is. And not be tempted, because you're going to smell it, you're going to see it, you're going to see people using it, you're going to start to ruminate about how great it was the last time you used, right? Don't be dumb, right? If you have emotional issues, and every drug addict I've ever worked with has either emotional or cognitive or both, get help and work on those issues. If you solve, and I'll say it again, if you solve the internal problems, you will fix the external manifestation of the behavior, which is the drugs and alcohol, right? So if you're a musician, and people will sometimes say, well, gosh, you know, I'm a recording artist, and I go into the recording studio, and there's drugs in that studio. Go to a different flipping studio. Hire musicians who don't do drugs. Or if they do drugs, make it a rule, if you want to play on my record, if you want to support me, you cannot come stoned, you cannot come drunk, you cannot have that shit on you, you can't take pot breaks between songs. If I find that shit on you, you're fired, and I'm not paying you, and I'm erasing the tape and bringing somebody else in. Be, you know, grow up here. Get strong. Man up or woman up and say, I'm not dealing with that crap, and you can't bring that shit in here. I don't play with people who use drugs, period. I don't have them when I record. I won't play with them on a regular basis. Now, if somebody hires me to do a fill-in and the other guys in the band are playing or doing drugs, okay, that's fine. It's not my band. If I'm running the show, there is not a single person that's pulling a drug out. They're fired. Done. They show up to the show drunk or stoned, they're done. Boom. End of story. They're not paid for the show, and that's their last show. They're done. So you have to take very active, very assertive things to keep yourself sober. Take it into your own hands. Don't wait for God or Allah or Buddha or Satan or any other god or deity to do your work for you. Don't wait for your social support system to do the work for you. Don't wait for your boyfriend, girlfriend, wife, lover, house, pet, whatever, to do the work for you. You've got to be proactive as heck. Start predicting what areas and what situations are difficult for you, and figure out coping tools or figure out escape avoidant tools where you will be going to those places that'll encourage you to use drugs. You know, if you're trying to lose weight, you don't eat ice cream and you don't go to, you know, to ice cream places, that's great. But if you like, you know, if you're a big, if you're a big chicken nuggets guy, right, and Joe's Chicken Nugget Factory is right next to Haagen-Dazs ice cream, go eat another chicken nugget place. Don't go to a place that's near a place that sells your drug of choice, right, whether that's ice cream or Coca-Cola or girls or guys or whatever. You've got to be smart about this crap. You've got to engage your brain. You have to be an active participant in this, or you're not going to make it. So those, if you look at the people that make it, those are the kind of things that they do that other people who don't make it don't do.
Gotcha. Okay.
I mean, it's work. I'm not going to kid you.
Oh yeah. And very likely that may be why some people struggle with it so much. A lot of people are not taught coping skills, and they get into adulthood not knowing how to adult, as in the vernacular lately.
Yeah.
And
you're right.
So they wake up in the middle of it, and it's like, well, don't you know how to do these things? And they don't, but you're going to have to ask somebody, speak up. You can't professionally fall apart and let people,
absolutely.
Out of my way of talking about people just throw up their hands. They have no resiliency, and that, you know how I feel about that.
Well, and you know, it's the same thing for me, because there's some areas that I am clearly, you know, dumber than a post about. And I don't make any bones about the fact that I'm dumber than a post about it. And I have no problem going, hey, can you like take me by the hand and wipe my tush and, you know, clean up my drool and show me how to do this? You know, I have no problem doing that. You know, because we all have strengths and we all have weaknesses.
Yeah.
There's no shame in any of that. We're all human.
Yep. All right. I am going to go to the next part, which will probably raise some of this again. I don't want to sound like I'm repeating myself, but the last part I want to talk about, because we're getting close to the end of the show, is resources and support, how to break the patterns, or how to cope with someone who won't. I do want to say here, and I believe Dr. Mathis probably will agree with me, that certainly while many addictive substances or other behaviors are not at all easy to stop, that despite this fact, it really is still a matter of won't rather than can't to stop an addictive behavior. Now, is it easy? Absolutely not, and we're not saying otherwise, but it is simple, and it is in people's power and ability, especially if they authentically do utilize the support systems that are out there for them. So, you know, as we were just talking about, I'm sure that you, Dr. Mathis, have some thoughts on specific steps that people can best empower someone to break their addiction and stay clean. We've hit on this somewhat. I don't know if there are further things that you want to say, but mostly what I'm digging at is that while all of this is obvious and simple, if somebody's just really fucking bad at this, you know, what do you think maybe are the first handful of things that they need to focus on if they're going to get through this? What would you say?
Call a professional who does this on a regular basis, who doesn't just blurt out 12-step epithets and well, you can take a horse to water, but you can't make a drink one day at a time. If you always did what you always done, you've always get what you always got. Well, no shit. Okay? Talk to somebody who can give you concrete advice and support, because your clinician has to be supportive too. And if you need, you know, and somebody like BMX, and I'm not slamming him in any way, shape, or form. Please don't miss what I'm going to say. But somebody with BMX has the financial resources to see somebody like me daily. Right? Don't be a dumbass about it. If you need to see your therapist and can afford to do so daily, do it, particularly in the first 6 months, because most people, if they're going to relapse, they're going to relapse in the first 3 to 6 months. Statistically speaking, we know that already. So you got to really get on your game those first 6 months. And if that means you need to see a therapist multiple times a week, figure out a way you can do that if at all possible. And I know that's not possible for everybody, but if you can do it, do it. Figure out ways to circumvent when you have cravings. Be sure that you have people you can call when you have cravings, friends you can hang out with, activities you can do, whether they're breathing, meditational, mindfulness stuff, walks in the park, playing with your pet. I don't care. But you've got to plan in advance. You've got to anticipate urgings and cravings, and figure out before they, before they happen, you've got to figure out a plan. You can't wait till the proverbial feces at the rotating blades to go, I feel like dog crap now. Let me see what I can do other than use. Gosh, I really want to use. Oh, my God. Because now your brain's going to start ruminating about getting immediate gratification because that's what you're used to doing. So yeah. You've got to make plans in advance. You've got to anticipate, what are my triggers? What are my weak points? What are the places that are going to be likely difficult? And plan in advance how you're going to deal with those. Social support might be one of them. Meditation might be one. Taking a walk might be one. Calling your therapist and saying, hey, I know this is after hours. Can you please give me 10 minutes on the phone? Right? That's part of the reason that I work 7 days a week, and I joke about it, you know, and say I'm really a closet masochist, which is probably true also, but that's another story. I really do. I work 7 days a week, and I'm the only guy in town that makes house calls. And I do it because I deal with this kind of population. And if you have a clinician who is a 9-to-5 kind of guy or gal, and they don't want to take your calls, and they're not willing to call you, find a flip another practitioner. Find somebody who gives a flip about whether you live or die or whether you are staying sober or not, and make sure that clinician is on board with you because they have to be a partner with you. And if you have to go inpatient for the first week or two to get clean, to get detoxed, great. But we already know from years and years and years and years in research that inpatient is not the first treatment of choice. What the first treatment of choice is aggressive outpatient. We know that from over 60 years of research. And usually Inpatient's what people do to start out with, and that's not what they need to be doing. But they've been sold a bag of worms because the medical profession wants to make money. And I'm not slamming people, everybody in the medical profession, but I'm just telling you what the way it is. Hospitals want to make money, and that's how they make money. The first primary.
That was the next question is why inpatient isn't that great, but mm-hmm. That's not so much
ding,
worse.
Ding.
It's not about
well, and
helping.
You know, and if you need to be protected from yourself for a couple of weeks or a month, and you know, or you need to get detoxed for 2 weeks because you're on a drug that you have to do a step down on, okay,
oh,
great.
Yeah.
But as soon as you get that crap out of your system, get the heck out and get real therapy. Don't be warehoused in a hospital because what most of those people do is if they do any therapy at all, it's usually by lower echelon staff. And their version of therapy is attending 12-step meetings, and that's certainly better than nothing, and I'm not slamming that, but that's not therapy. That is social and existential support, and that's great, but get some real therapy. That in and of itself is not going to keep you sober.
Yeah.
You have got to access as many different resources as possible, and you've got to be proactive, and you got to do that nasty four-letter word work, and it is work. And I'll say it again, it's not easy and it does require effort, but it's easier than dying. And I mean, no disrespect to BMX or any other folks who've OD'd or haven't made it or have died of drug-related causes, whether they deteriorated heart valves or whatever. And I really am not being nasty about this. But it's better than dying. It's better than going bankrupt. It's better than losing relationships, your house, whatever, your self-esteem, what's left of it. It's just not your job. It's not worth it.
Yeah.
It's better to do the work now than to pay interest and penalties later. And that's what I tell all my addicts. This is a lot of work, but it's better to do it now because you're going to pay for it sooner or later. The feces are going to hit the rotating blades. Let's do it now and minimize the cleanup.
Yeah. And I think probably one more thing that I think you will also agree with me on is I think we need to normalize getting therapy. A lot of these people come from family situations or social situations. It's 2021, and frickin' mental health help is still stigmatized in this country. There's still huge pockets of the country where that is a shameful thing. And you've got to get away from that. Don't surround yourselves with people that still buy that bullshit. You know, we know better now, and it's time to let that go. Sometimes people don't have support or clinicians that are on board or anything else because everybody stigmatizes this stuff. and they stigmatize being honest about your situation, your family. You know, if you can't go to them and say, look, I'm really stuck. I need you guys to stop bringing the booze over and stop bringing your party pals and all that. You need family and friends that are going to say, okay, and mean it.
Real
walk
family
that walk.
And real friends. Yeah.
Yes. And
yeah, it's kind of like the old joke.
Professionals, you know, can hopefully intervene. You know, as long as you don't get a 12
stepper. It's kind of like the old joke that anybody sees a shrink needs their head examined.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the attitude that a lot of people have about this. You know.
Yeah. And that attitude is gonna kill people. To be blunt.
Because
they won't go get help. They won't get help. And so that is something that people can do, whether you're the addict or the support system, is
absolutely
make it normal to go get this help.
Yeah.
Make it acceptable. You're not going to get fired. You're not going to get picked on. You're not going to get broken up with. You know,
right.
Make that go away as much as you can, and don't put up with it from other people.
Right. And you're not a bad person. You're not a weak person. You're a person who hasn't found the solution to your problem. That's the reality.
Yeah.
It says
yeah.
nothing about you except that you haven't been successful yet. And I love the Edison quote about, you know, I haven't failed 1,000 times. I just found 1,000 things that didn't work.
Oh, I don't know that one. That's pretty cool. I like that.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and it just really boils down to that. And people who, you know, they come in and they feel kind of embarrassed or ashamed or whatever. And I'm like, so are you embarrassed to go to a physician if you, you know, break your arm? No. Are you embarrassed to go back to the same physician 6 months later if you get a cold? No. Then why are you embarrassed to come back here? I mean, come on.
Other people put it on them.
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah. Well, and, you know, and as you said, you know, grow up in a society that's like, ooh, you're doing what? You know, and it's not like you're in New York seeing a psychoanalyst that's, you know, or Chicago, or even Atlanta, seeing a psychoanalyst, because that's more cheek human to boner. Right.
Oh, all right. I see what you did there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, in all seriousness, ask for help. Go to a professional. Keep going to a professional until you get what you need. Don't put up with less. I know easier said than done. I know some people can't afford treatment that their insurance is not covering. That's a whole other problem. You know, some insurances won't pay for what you actually need. But I guess the thing is, keep asking, keep changing people until you get someone that listens to you, and just insist on it, demand it, and get your friends to help you and get your doctor to help you or whoever. Find an advocate of some kind. You know, it's about the only thing I can really say to it.
Yeah.
So we've kind of covered our talking points. Is there anything else that you want to touch on before we wrap up here?
No, I'm good. I would just say get the best help you can and the best help you can afford, and never give up, because recovery is definitely possible. There is no two ways about it. We have, you know, many examples of people who have conquered this problem, but it does take a lot of work, it does take a lot of effort, and in some cases it does take a lot of resources to do it, but it can be done. And you know, I feel like the alternative is a no-brainer. So it's like, okay, well, do I do this now, or do I suffer medical and or physical and or more psychological scenarios later? I mean, you really don't have a choice. I mean, you do, but you don't. You don't have a good choice. You either get help or you suffer. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Okay. All right. With that, we are at the end of our show. So on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, I want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who might be joining us later. And I know there are several of you who have reached out to me over the last few weeks. So we have a lot of late listeners who are not here on Wednesday night. They come down later on through podcasts, iTunes, et cetera. You know, you can also play these directly on the website. If you go to the link, it'll be saved as a file. So however you come and see us, We're happy to have you, and we will see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion, and that'll be Wednesday, April 28th, 11 p.m., as always, right here on blogtalkradio.com. And real quick, I want to give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows that are coming up in the next couple of weeks until we see you again. Tomorrow night, Thursday Travel It's Radio, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. San Francisco's Pier 39, a Bayside entertainment mecca adjacent to Fisherman's Wharf, is the best place to catch a sightseeing cruise between the Golden Gate and San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridges. Travel It's Radio presents two guests, Pier 39 Harbor Master Sheila Chandor and Blue and Gold Fleet President Patrick Murphy, son of the cruise line's founder, as they talk with hosts Dan Schlossberg and Mary Ellen Nugent-Lake. Next, Saturdays, Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday morning extravaganza, 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and that will be happening on the 17th and the 24th before we see you again. The Monday morning quarterbacks are live on Saturday mornings. Hide your wife, hide your kids, hide your dog. All right, Sunday the 18th, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, the Fear the Walking Dead online viewing party, hosted by moi, is back with Season 6, Episode 9, Things Left to Do, on AMC. Please join us online and or on the air by phone for real-time discussions, updates, trivia, profiles on the cast and crew, and more. The following Sunday, the 25th, will be Season 6, Episode 10, Handle with Care. Monday at 10 p.m. is Monday Night in America every week with Roger Noriega, who brings his unique take on politics, current events, entertainment, sci-fi, and history. This show may alternate occasionally on some Mondays with his new show, The Nightmare Hunter, with Roger Noriega in the same time slot. And then last Tuesday, the 20th, 420, man, speaking of addictions, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Fandom Access, Week in Review. Join the lovable linguists Jamie, Kieran, and AJ as they dive into another night of television. Please look for The Rock and Roll Shrink on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and on the web at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Good to see you as always, and rock on. Good night.